Greetings, citizens of Earth. You are barking a happy tune with my pal Smurf of Smurf and the Magic Tones on 5280 Geek.
From the Mobile 5280 Studios, Weekend Geek Update. Smurf here at Barnes & Noble for the premiere, the release, the launch party of Straight Out of Deadwood. We were here last year with Mr. David Boop, who is given us the honor and the privilege of being here for the sequel from last year's, what was it?
2 years ago, actually.
Was it 2 years?
2 years ago.
Jesus.
Tombstone.
Tombstone. The Tombstone was great because we had Butcher and everybody, but now we have a whole new cavalcade of authors that are donating their skill, their talent, and their immense imagination to the next anthology. I have next to me DJ Butler, who you will be leaving shortly for another signing. What's it like being that busy?
I've been famous for a long time, so I've learned to cope.
It's that slower. It's the hat because you got like the Bonanza hat
this
going
is a
on
brand
right
new
here.
Hat. This is a,
I like this.
This is a high crown. The color is bone.
Bone. Okay.
Actual beaver fur fedora made by Tatton Baird Hatters in Springville, Utah.
I'm impressed.
Thank you. So I got a book. The character who is in Straight Out of Deadwood is also in a novel that just came out 2 days ago. As I have new series come out, I wear hats. The basic problem is that I'm bald. But also
from wearing hats for too long.
No. Oh, hell no. I discovered I was bald, and then I started wearing hats.
Oh, okay.
But I also wear hats to kind of, to be memorable and to market the characters a bit. So the character in the story and in the novel wears a fedora. So this is brand new. This is the first time I've worn this hat is today, driving over from Utah.
I'm liking it.
It's got that new hat smell.
It does, yeah, and it doesn't smell like, you know, sort of cheap felt. It's like a beaver, so this is a very fancy hat for me.
It smells like fresh game kill, is that what you're saying?
It's old game. You know,
old game.
Handled game.
So you wear all different hats for different book releases. So what other books have you released, and what were the corresponding hats with that?
So I discovered that I was bald at Denver Comic Con in 2016, and I can tell you that because it was the weekend of release of my novel, The Kidnap Plot, and the character, the protagonist Charlie in that book, wears a John Bull, which is the English name for a short top hat. Sometimes gets called names like a dead man's hat or an undertaker's hat in the U.S. And I was starting to get photographed by a lot of people and posted on Facebook. And this is how I discovered that my hairline was about 3 inches back from where I had imagined it was. So I called my wife and said, look, either I'm going to shave my head like Kojak or I'm going to buy a hat. And there's a nice John Bull here. What do you want me to do? She said, wear a hat.
All right.
So I wore that for a year. I've got a couple of tricorn hats, a black and a...
The captain hats for pirates and
I do get
1700s.
I get a lot of R-matey walking through airports. Actually, the Delta first class check-in, they know me. If I don't wear a hat, they go, where's the hat?
When wow.
Because I travel all the time.
That is impressive.
Yeah.
Nobody recognizes me for those reasons.
Yeah.
That's impressive.
And earlier this year, I haven't had a chance to wear it very much yet. It's kind of like a portable mullet. It's a hat made of about 1.5 badger pelts. So it looks like a badger is lying on your head with its face
just
down
dead.
On your forehead, dead. And then there's the extra, maybe it's 1.3 badger pelts. The other pelt makes a cap around the head so it'll stay.
I think I saw that hat in Christmas Story.
Yes, I think you did.
I feel sorry for the one animal that's only got...
The 0.3?
Yeah, it only has two-thirds of its pelt now.
The rest of him was made into a very nice Possibles bag.
Oh. Very nice. Linings for gloves, perhaps?
Yeah, no, it's just the exterior, like a shoulder pouch.
Okay.
But yeah, that's for a character and a story set in the early 19th century. And Hiram Woolley is a 20th century character who wears a fedora. So I went and had a fedora made.
Wow.
Yeah.
So are there haberdasheries that you can actually visit and have hats made these days?
Oh, yeah.
I can't find one for crap. And so everyone just has ball caps. So
let me plug then. So
okay.
This is located in Springville, Utah. Now, I don't know if they work over the phone. They probably do.
I'm sure in this day and age.
The guy's name is Chandler. Ooh, I forget his last name. But they are purely custom-made hats, purely custom-made hats, and it's high-end. And it's not just fedoras. They'll do whatever you like.
Okay.
Yeah, Tatton, T-A-T-T-O-N, Baird, B-A-I-R-D.
I actually found a hatter down in Colorado Springs once before a convention.
Oh.
I was not planning to appear at it, and thus I had not brought my fedora, which is what I had been wearing a lot at the time. I was just stopping in to say hi, and they said, we need you to do some interviews and sit on some panels. And I'm like, okay, but I don't have my hat. And I felt really weird being up there without a hat. And it's like I'd never appeared without a hat before. So downtown Colorado Springs, there was a hat shop, and I found a Sinatra. They had a whole line of the Sinatra fedoras. And luckily there was one that fit, but they said, oh, you know, we can custom size it for you, custom make one for you. And I'm like, I don't have time. I've got to be on stage in half an hour.
What can you do for me now?
Yeah, exactly. But, by God, I was on stage with a hat.
Nice. All right. So with the multiple hats, how does that work with your character development? Does it help you get into the mindset? Do you write with a hat on?
No, I mostly write in my jammies, actually.
Nice.
But I think...
So I'm not the only one. I thought I was a weirdo that way.
You're not the only one.
Okay.
I'd write naked, but I have kids. And I am bald. But also, look, in this game, you want to write a book, but you also want to be read. And that means you got to get people to remember you. And usually it means they have to see you more than one time. And I'm two things. One, I'm really tall. Although
you are tall.
Yeah, I was disappointed to discover this weekend I've shrunk 3/4 of an inch from my height. I got measured for the first time ever in 30 years. It was a bummer. I'm now under 6'7".
Oh, my God, how hard it must be for you. I'm a freaking midget.
I feel humiliated.
And you're bitching about 6'7".
It is hard.
Oh, my God.
And then I wear weird hats, right? So I'm that, that's the tall guy with the hat. Right?
Nice.
And I think it works. People remember me.
All right. So when you're writing and all that, is there a preference? Do you find comfort in a subject or a world easier than another? Or where do you like to fall into for your writing?
That's interesting. When you say where do you like to fall into, do you mean like what do I like to write about or how do I start writing?
What do you like to write about? How do you get into that? Because I've interviewed a lot of creatives, and each one has like their own process and how they get into that mindset. Travis is here. We've had on multiple times, and he, you know, sacrifices a live chicken, dances underneath a moon, and, you know, runs around the neighborhood naked.
I do that
enough.
Too, but it doesn't help me write. No, I actually, here's what I do. I procrastinate until fear that I will never do it causes me to sit down and start writing. And then I do it all very fast. And then I do the edits. I still have a day job, and actually a day job that travels and is in some seasons has really high hours. I don't have the luxury of always being able to write in the same place or to be able to like carry around music with me or whatever. So I've written plenty of chapters on in airline seats or. In hotel rooms or sitting in my front room. So I don't actually write naked. I'm sorry to disappoint you.
Damn.
Yeah.
One day.
I don't fly that kind of airline.
new frontier was going to new areas, so, you know.
Yeah, yeah. I don't actually have a ritual.
All right.
Yeah.
Now, with Straight Out of Deadwood, with it being an anthology, what is the premise of your story, or what's going on when we catch up with your characters?
So the story is actually driven by real history, ultimately. There's a guy named Chief Wakara, who was a Shoshone chief in Utah Valley, died in the year 1855. And he fought the Mormon settlers in the late 1840s. They called it Walker's War. He was called Chief Walker. And they weren't really good at telling the Utes from the Shoshone, so they thought he was a Ute. A lot of the old sources said he's a Ute. Apparently he's a Shoshone.
All right. Trying to keep out those pesky Mormons.
Yeah. And eventually they made peace. And as part of the condition of making peace, one of the Mormon elders sort of made a personal friendship with him and promised he would speak at Wakara's funeral. So went to the funeral and left an account of it. So there's these two white Mormon guys here, right? 1855, Millard Fillmore is president. They ride Wakara out, and he's dead, and he is tied to his horse, and they've got a letter to him from Brigham Young in his hand to prove that he is a mighty person, that he corresponds with the chief of the Mormoni. Okay.
Okay.
They bring him out here. They sacrifice two of his wives. Okay.
Holy
they killed them
crap.
And put them in the tomb. And these white Mormon guys are like, shit. What do we do? Right? Because they're afraid.
Get him a third wife?
It's a tenuous kind. Well, there's that. It's sort of a tenuous peace still, right? They're afraid that if they say, stop, that they're going to start shooting again. So they stand there. And they kill two wives, and then they put him in the cave, seal it up, and they chain two Paiute slave children to the outside to stay there to serve him and his dead wives. And they're alive, but they're left there to starve to death.
Oh, my God.
And the Mormon guy, I forget his name now, keeps his word. He delivers a funeral oration to this to Chief Wakara. So, by the way, later his body mysteriously disappears, right, and is allegedly relocated somewhere up in the Uinta Mountains. So the story is not about Wakara. He's not the point of view character. The story is about a 1930s farmer named Hiram Woolley, who is a sugar beet farmer who knows traditional American magical lore from his grandma. And about Wakara's ghost, who when a herd of cattle is a herd of horses is relocated where the body has been reburied, the ghost rustles the cattle. Wakara was called by one historian the greatest horse thief who ever lived. He rode to California from Utah to rustle 2,000 head of horses on one occasion.
Wow.
So it's about him coming back to rustle horses one last time.
One last time.
And about...
riders in the sky, so to speak.
Yeah, and as Hiram Woolley kind of figures out that this is what's happening, he sort of offers him a substitute kind of imaginary horse to get him to return the horses back.
Wow. Yeah.
What I love about this story, when he first told me about it, and I'm like, okay, there's a lot to unpack here. But then I read it, it was the first time reading about Hiram. And the character's so fascinating because he's a man who has strong beliefs. But then there's also this supernatural element that he can't ignore. And he walks this line between, you know, our world and the next. And he's so interesting. And his thought processes to figure out things is so interesting. I just absolutely fell in love with the story, and I was so glad Dave honored us with it.
Yeah, I can see why. I mean, I'd need to dive into this because it's impressive.
Thank you. I was very honored to be invited.
No, all right. So, Dave, yet again, you've dipped your toe into the anthology. You didn't learn anything from the last time?
So what happened was Tombstone did really, really, really well. And I was like, well, so that's what it's like when people read you. Lots of people were reading Tombstone, and it made me kind of hungry to do it again. I wanted to give more stories like that because, you know, weird Westerns are not known as a best-selling genre, for the most part. You know, we've had some good steampunk bestsellers and stuff like that. But as a whole, most people relegate weird Westerns to TV or movies. They don't think of it in the lines of fiction. But, of course, those of us who write and read weird Western knows that there is quite a bit of it out there being published, good stuff. And when I came up with Tombstone, I wanted to start the dialogue about, hey, these are some people who are writing this genre that you may not know a lot about, but this is what they're doing. These are their worlds, and maybe you should spend some time here. And the response was so good that I was like, okay, I want to bring a whole nother set of authors, another set that maybe people don't know about, or some people who are known for something else writing those characters in a weird Western setting. So, you know, going out and starting to gather the authors that I knew would provide, again, good entertainment, good solid fiction was very fun, and so much so that I actually did a dual reading. I read for two anthologies at the same time and split them between the two, so that we have Deadwood and then in February Dodge City coming out. So,
oh, wow.
So we will have...
So you've got a follow-up already in the hopper.
Yes, it is. It is coming out, and so we may end up be doing this again sometime in February or March. but what was great, and I hadn't planned this way, but of course I know a lot of the Colorado authors, and I know which ones write weird Westerns or steampunk, and I also know some people that I wanted to work with for years. And even though I did this dual reading, almost all of the Colorado authors ended up in Deadwood. So this is why we have such a Colorado-centric
presence
anthology this time. Mm-hmm. Yes, including Steve over here, who is...
Steve Rasnick, who's been very quiet.
Yeah, so I'm not wearing a hat, so I have to...
You don't stand out nearly as much.
Maybe I should wear a hat, though, given the state of my hair.
But you know, the opportunity to work with him and some of my friends that have been with me since the beginning of my journey as a writer and editor, like Travis and Mario and Betsy, and it was too good of an opportunity to pass up. And so this one, Straight Out of Deadwood, I call it my Empire Strikes Back, because a lot
that's
of
that's a tall order, sir.
Well. It is darker than Tombstone, you know, I could say most of the stories, the good guys don't necessarily win. They may survive, but they don't necessarily always win. And that's kind of what I was going for, is I wanted something that kind of showed that the West was a dangerous place, even without zombies and dragons and vampires and all the stuff like that. So then you add those elements, and what people were up against was very challenging. But then when we get to Dodge City, there's more of that hope. No Ewoks, though. But hope
aww.
That you saw in Return of the Jedi of the hope of a future. So that's kind of why I returned to this world.
Sorry, I was in mid thought. Mr. Steve Rasnick, sitting on the end of the table there.
It's Steve Rasnick, Tim. Three names.
Oh, sorry. I'm awful with names. It is, and now I'm just screwing it up on purpose.
I don't let people drop my short last name.
Oh, okay. Now you have a story in Deadwood as well.
Yeah.
How long have you been writing, or have you been long at this craft, or?
It's a little over 45 years now.
Wow.
Published a little over 450 short stories, 7 novels, 11 collections. Most of those are horror. Actually, I think this is only my 3rd weird Western out of all that.
Okay.
But yeah, I've been around mostly in the horror fiction circles. I write occasional science fiction and a few mysteries.
Excellent. So, do you like horror or sci-fi? Or, I mean, are you pulled towards it?
I've always had kind of a dark turn of the imagination. For a long time, I was trying to figure out what I wanted to write. I was a graduate student in creative writing, and I was an English major. Read a great deal of fiction. Read mostly mainstream. I don't think I really read horror fiction until toward the end of my college years. But I was looking for something that talked about realities that weren't the physical realities you could see around you, but that were at the same time just as true.
Mm-hmm.
And when I started reading horror fiction, it's a light turned on that this seemed to be a kind of fiction that was about very real things, but the real things also were the things that of the imagination, things that were in your dreams, but still had an emotional significance as strong as, well, relationship with your family or your friends or anyone else.
So what scares you?
well, pretty much everything is unbelievable.
Right.
I think mostly the kinds of things that really frighten me are, well, loss of a family member, loss of a friend, death. Of the ordinary fears, I guess I've always had a severe fear of heights.
Okay.
I know when I was in college, we in the library there was a really tall spiral staircase, which eventually they had to kind of fence in because of all the students were jumping over the railing to commit suicide.
Oh, my God. Which, midterms aren't that hard.
Well, yeah. Well, when they actually did that, I thought, well, yeah, I can see that, because every time I walked up that staircase, one of my fears was, well, this is so scary. What if I went crazy and just jumped off the edge?
Wow. Okay.
Which was a strange feeling and something, well, other people must have had that fear, and they overcame it, unfortunately.
There's actually a term for that now, and I can't remember what it was, but I recently read an article about that desire to, you know, say, jump off of a high place or just turn yourself into traffic or whatever, that a lot of people experience it. It's like that little voice in the back of our head that says, what if, you know, and under most cases, you know, we go, that's crazy, and shove that voice back down.
That seems like a bad idea.
Yeah.
I should seek therapy.
Yeah. But then...
I think it's normal to feel the urge and not do it.
Right.
Not so normal to feel the urge and go for it.
Right. And that's where the mental break is when people...
Dabbling in the dark areas.
Yeah. So...
Interesting. The new voice you just heard is not Siri. It is Alex Axe.
Definitely not Siri.
Definitely not
Siri. I'm like,
Siri,
if Siri was like, hey, go fuck yourself.
Wow. That is awesome.
Now, sorry, I should have asked, am I allowed to do swears?
Have you heard me cuss already multiple
okay,
times?
Okay, that's true. I like have a mouth like a trucker. I used to work in construction.
Well, I was going to say construction or retail. They're not too far apart. So you used to work construction. Now you're an author?
I've been like an author for the last... 9 years? Oh, God. Has it been like that long?
It's getting there.
Well, it's not an overnight process, contrary to popular belief.
No,
people think
not.
I write some stuff on paper and I'm going to get a movie deal tomorrow.
Yeah. So, I mean, I was like, I actually have a degree in geology and I was a geologist for a while. And then because the oil industry has like busted several times and you can't get a job anymore, then I was in construction and, you know, just day job.
Oh, okay.
That's what you got to do. Pay your bills.
Boom.
Yep.
Need to collect the paycheck.
Yep. That's exactly it.
So how did you end up in this then? Did he just wrangle you? Did you build Dave's house?
No, I was minding my own business.
There's a little hesitation here. You came close.
Well, see, I did dirt work, so it would be more like, did I bury Dave's house? Like,
or bury Dave until he gave you a saw in the anthology?
Yeah, yeah. No. Yeah, just,
sorry.
It's okay. The dirt will go away. Just keep breathing. It's fine. But
What happened was I was searching for people who had, you know, we're writing weird westerns or horror westerns or steampunk or whatever, and I'm doing these searches because I want to make sure that, you know, I'm getting the people who are out there working and doing this.
Mm-hmm.
And Alex's name came up, and I'm like, I know that name, but you see, I knew her more as Alex. What?
Them.
I knew them as Alex Wells, and so. I was confused until I saw the picture. I'm like, oh, got it. And so, yeah, I Alex had a spot, right? You know, had
instantly
to, had to.
Well, I mean, how can you resist such a charming smile? Come on. this is a question for all of you guys. and we've talked about it on the podcast, and you guys may be unaware, but are we in a golden age of horror? Do you guys, I mean, I think this book is hitting precisely at the right time. The precursor, of course, with Tombstone, and now Deadwood. Have you been getting into the horror side? Do you think this is the revitalization of the horror?
Well, certainly we're in a golden age of horror short stories, but we're in a golden age of fantastic, imaginative short stories of all kinds. I think I've been doing this for decades, and I think there are more good or even excellent writers of short stories now than there ever have been.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, I would say, like, the consensus is really that this is, like, the new golden age of science fiction and fantasy and short stories. And I know, like, my agent is just, like, waiting for horror to kind of come, like, novels to come roaring back. Which I don't know that much about horror because I'm a giant weenie, so like.
And yet you're writing horror.
It's no. I don't know.
It borders on. It's definitely dark. No.
Cool.
What's happening is we have shorter attention spans. Our audience has shorter attention spans than they used to. The idea of push technology, pushing stories out, whether they be 100 words, 1,000 words, 3,000 words. Getting those to our cell phones, our tablets, and so forth, is more and more prevalent. So the great thing about an anthology like what we have, and I've balanced the lengths of the stories to, you know, from novella almost to flash fiction in it, is people can invest a short period of time, get a story that they hopefully will then follow up with other things by the author, but then they can, you know, move back into their lives or whatever. It's great for that. This is what short fiction has always been trying to do. It's been a gateway drug into novels, and I really hope that the people who read Deadwood that like a particular story will seek out the works of the author.
The writer is also
so say we all.
And the market for mainstream short stories is pretty small and usually doesn't pay. But the market for fantasy, science fiction, and horror short stories is still large and growing.
Mm-hmm.
So if you come out of graduate school and you write short fiction, you love short fiction, even if you weren't normally a science fiction fan or a fantasy fan, the idea of actually having your work appear in professional publications is always attractive.
Right.
And so you see all these anthologies and magazines out which have genre fiction in them. And so that in itself, I think, attracts a lot of writers.
Well, and then the other, Netflix is definitely coming strong with the short stories because, I mean, they've got two strong shows, Love, Death, and Robots, of course, which is an amalgamation of different sci-fi, horror, steampunk, and all of that. And then, of course, I laughed because I totally thought of this was The Ballad of Buster Scruggs, which was a bunch of Western shorts that I honestly was waiting for Dave to make a cameo appearance in because it just seems so up your alley.
Well, if they if anybody's listening and there's a season two.
Yeah.
So. I don't know. We may see. I don't know. Buster Scruggs, the early years.
But one of the great things is, you know, we talk about the you know, the diversifying the length of the stories, but also diversifying the types of stories that I have in there. Steve's story is actually one of the more lighter ones, even though it's a dark story ultimately in the end. It's definitely it kind of breaks up the story. Tell them about the guy that you based your character on. This guy is hilarious.
Well, the story is based on. I was trying to tell a tall tale.
Mm-hmm.
Because tall tales was one way that I first got into fantasy. As a kid, I read tall tales like Paul Bunyan and Pecos Bill. And so this anthology gave me a chance to write a tall tale. So I was looking for real Colorado legends that I could use or mash together for a story, and a couple things that I came up with was there's a figure in Colorado ghost lore called J. Dawson Hidgepath, and there have been a number of stories about him, but basically he was a real person who apparently at one point in his life just proposed marriage to every female he met. They could be little girls, they could be old women, they could be married women, it didn't matter. Just every single female he met, he would propose marriage to them, and if if that wasn't irritating enough, the legend is, after he died, he continued to do this.
Well, if you're good at something.
And I've read that actually this person was buried in a western Colorado town, and they eventually had to dig him up and move his bones because his proposals continued.
Mm-hmm.
So wow. I based one of my characters on that. The other thing I found out was there was a legendary figure called the Slide Rock Bolter. And for lack of a better term, I guess the Slide Rock Bolter is a kind of Rocky Mountain land whale, which was supposed to hang out around the cliffs and periodically would slide down with its mouth open and devour unwary prospectors or anyone passing by. And at the same time, the whale had little finger hooks on the back of his tail fin, which he used to crawl back up the mountain.
I like that.
Reestablish it. As outlandish as that seems, that was a real Colorado legend. And I, once reading that, I really couldn't resist writing about it.
I thought he had made it up until I was doing research for another project, and I pulled out this book from 1910 called Fearsome Creatures of the Lumberwoods, and there's
and lo and behold,
Bolter, and I'm like, what?
Yeah, well, the thing is, if I was just making it up, I would never make up anything that silly. So,
come on, that's not silly. That's just that's full. It's a tall tale. Yeah, I mean, it's so full of just
my imagination usually goes to things a little bit darker and a little bit more realistic, but this was fun to do.
I can imagine. So when you're, is it more difficult to write a short story, do you think, than a full novel?
Yeah.
To get everything in when you deal with a short story? Because at least with a novel, you have room, sort of.
It depends on the writer. I have novelist friends who say they can't write a short story for anything. They try and they just can't do it. On the other hand, I've written over 500 short stories, published over 450. And for me, not only does my imagination go to that form, I'm really addicted to the thrill you get in finishing a story. Mm. And the problem with novels is it takes forever to finish. And I find I often don't have the patience. I've written some, but I'm proud of them, but I have to say they're just not as much fun. Is writing a short story.
So I'm just going to waylay Steve in the parking lot after this and eat his brain, like, well, absorb his powers.
Do you need hot sauce for that?
Yeah, and no offense to the all the people writing novels this month in NaNoWriMo, but yes, a novel, it does take a good deal of time to develop, and I agree, the short does have... does have a lot of great benefits, and it's a great way again to hone ideas and skill sets and so forth. I write in POVs I would never write a novel in, just to try them out, just to hear them, to see whether or not I can do that.
Which actually brings me to a good question: how important is your outline when you guys are working on your stories? Do you hold true to, do you even do an outline?
Well, I was going to say, that's, you've just like stumbled into it to like trench that, warfare.
Yeah,
like.
That's a whole nother podcast.
Yeah.
I would say let's...
Because it's so individual, like, and actually, like, it can change from novel to novel, where you're like, oh, this one was super outline, and then this next one, I don't know what I'm doing. I'm just sitting here just typing, like, stuff's happening, cool.
I can't finish a novel unless I outline it. I never outline a short story.
No.
For me, that's the big difference.
Yeah.
I've had to kind of outline short stories before, but I'm bad at short stories. They're hard to write. They're like, you're trying to fit so much into such a tiny space, and then you're like, what do you mean I can only have 4,000 words? I needed at least 12,000.
That's never going to work.
Yeah.
Well, we exit Steve, just to add, long time member, multiple podcasts, Mr. Travis.
Hello.
How are you?
Award-winning screenwriter.
Yes, actually, that is a new addition. I saw congratulations on the award you just received. Tell us about that.
It's been, I spent the last year trying to get into the screenwriting business, and one of the ways to do that is to enter your stuff in a lot of contests and go to film festivals and so on, and taking a couple trophies home this year. So
very nice, because we discussed that when you were at Dink with us.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. Well, once was at the Crimson Screen Film Festival for a and both of these actually were for short scripts, and once at the Genre Blast Film Festival. So that's been fun.
That's I'm actually don't have a question for that. I mean that's just so cool and impressive. So I mean, what was the story that won the award?
It's a short script called That Long Black Train. And it's actually based on my first professional short story sale by a short story of the same name that appeared in Cemetery Dance.
Oh. So. Excellent.
By its name, would I assume that it is also a weird Western of some sort?
No. It's a modern story. It's about a couple of Western backpackers in Vietnam.
Oh, okay.
Who find themselves on a train to hell.
Oh, very good.
Because where else would you end up?
and have to basically confront some of the things that they've done on their hell-raising tour across Southeast Asia.
You and the Asia ties.
Yeah, I love it.
You do?
Yeah, I lived in Japan for a while. I write a lot of Japanese tie-in stuff. So that's kind of my jam.
It is your jam. And Red actually even tried running your table at Denver Comic Con and sell some of your jam, but you were never there. She succeeded, yes.
Awesome.
Red tore it up for you, Liar. So we will be wrapping up here in a minute. How do they follow you, Alex, Travis? What's the best way to follow you guys, keep up with you? Does Mario want to talk? Mario's giving me, like, the mean eye right
yeah,
now.
You don't want to forget Mario.
Mario's just staring at me.
Admiringly.
No, there's nothing admiring.
Yeah. Well, before we wrap up, I do want to have Alex give a chance to talk about the story in Deadwood.
Yes.
If you will.
Okay, so, yeah, my story is about kind of like, I went very fantasy with it, where there are plague doctors that can create and cure diseases, and then the entire rail system is run by basically engineers that can take part of their soul and put it into a train, and that's what makes the train go. Mm. And two of them go to investigate a town that's had a cholera epidemic that turns out to be sort of like a magically engineered disease that's being tested by the Army of the West for more Indian extermination purposes.
Another one that it took a little bit to unpack, but oh my god, the characters are so rich.
Thank you.
Alex switches from points of view and does such a. You did, right?
Because you get half of it is from the plague doctor and half of it's from the Stokers.
Yeah. And it's so such completely dichotomy of character. To see the other one from the other one's point of view, that just brought this story to life. I just ate it up.
Yeah! Sorry, that's very exciting. But like, I mean, especially like the Stoker character, it's someone who has made like a terrible mistake in his life, and then he tried to like pretend that the mistake was intentional and totally a heroic thing. and then it's like, you know, but knowing that he's a fraud the entire time, and he's...
Ooh, a charlatan.
Yeah, and he's basically being offered a chance to actually be the person he's been pretending he is.
Oh, all right. How do they follow you, Alex, or where's the best way to keep up to date with what you got going on? Do you have anything else in the hopper besides what you've graced in
Well, I mean,
Deadwood?
So... Let's see, the best way to follow me, so I've got a Twitter account, at Katsu Donbury. If you go to katsudon.net, KATSUDON.net, that's my website. There is everything that I do there. And, I mean, I've written short stories. I would normally say like a decent number, but now I feel very sad and ashamed because I am like, you know, like
we're all at 5%. Different stages. It's okay.
I do have a duology of novels out from Angry Robot Books under the name Alex Wells, which is basically a space western with a mining rebellion, and everyone who's a Colorado native is like, oh, you named the towns after towns in Colorado, and that's because I did a lot of Colorado labor history reading to do those books. And that's Hunger Makes the Wolf and Blood Binds the Pack. Hunger Makes the Wolf won the Kitschies Golden Tentacle Award for Best Debut, which is so awkward to say, but that's what the award is actually called. And then I've written two steampunk novella collections that are also based in the Denver area that are Murder on the Titania and Other Steam-Powered Adventures and Wireless and More Steam-Powered Adventures. And Murder on the Titania was a finalist for the Colorado Book Award.
Mm.
Hey. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, very so, nice. Excellent. Mario, do you want to slip in over here? Do you want to say hi to the fans at home? Because you were on a couple years ago. Reluctantly. You were like, oh, okay.
No, thank you.
So, Mario, thank you. Well, thank you, Mario, for
I want to thank, first of all, David Boop for inviting me onto this into this anthology. It was a lot of fun writing the story, and I appreciate it.
What's your story in this one?
Jefe de la Comancheria. I actually have my vampires. My only short story it's the second short story with my main character, Felix Gomez, and he's been sent into the steampunk past, and he and his sidekick have to deliver somebody to... he's got a bounty on his head, so he have to deliver him to... the Jefe is the boss of the Comancheria. And... the Comancheria was a place in eastern Colorado, northern New Mexico, going all the way into the Texas Panhandle, maybe parts of Nebraska, where the Comanches lived.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a lot of intermingling, and they were what they call Comancheros. Some of you guys might know that. And they were basically the Mexicans who had been married off. Or the offspring of Mexicans and the Comanches and the Comancheros, and they were mainly merchants because they can go back and forth between the two worlds. But they also had a reputation of being kind of rough characters.
Mm.
So that's what I have here.
Kind of a bad bunch, if you will.
Yes, sort of. Yes.
And I know we're running out of time here, but I just also want to mention that, you know, one of the things everybody's like, well, when they reviewed the book, is like, well, there's not a lot of stories about Deadwood in here. And I'm like, well, it's more of a feel than a theme. But Travis actually did give me one of my bookended Deadwood stories. Shane Hensley, creator of Deadlands, the role-playing game, gave me the one at the beginning. And then Travis so kindly wrote one in Deadwood as well to give me to bookend it. And his story is...
What's yours about, Travis?
Pretty cool.
Well, mine is about the early days of the Deadwood mining camp, and what was I want to thank Dave for giving me the chance to write on this, because I love working on this story. It was so much fun because I'm a fan of the HBO series Deadwood.
Yes,
and one of the great,
even though the movie was such a disappointment,
I haven't seen it yet, so shut up.
Okay,
no spoilers.
No spoilers.
I think they say some naughty words in it.
There's a whole lot of dying.
What's great is that those characters are nearly all historical.
Mm-hmm.
So I got to sort of take those characters and play with them in my own little supernatural sandbox, and that was so much fun. And then plus, I about the time I was brainstorming / working on the story, I rode through there last year during the Sturgis motorcycle rally.
Right.
So I'm like in mm-hmm. Deadwood, right? And I go to the Gem Saloon, and mm-hmm. I go to the old Number 10 Saloon, and they like the places that were in the show. I mean, that nothing looks like it did.
No, they're all casinos or gift shops
right,
now.
Right.
So
right.
Disappointed.
But that was just really fun to sort of walk into that history and play with it. And so the story is about basically a supernatural creature who is drawn to Deadwood by the sort of unbridled greed and crime and pestilence and that the Deadwood mining camp was.
Right.
And then it causes even more mayhem. So.
Oh. I'm sold on all the stories. Mario, what have you been up to since we last saw you? Is this it?
No, I've been writing quite a bit.
Not to downplay anything.
No. I actually wrote quite a bit of short stories. There was a lot of discussion today about novels versus short stories. I was writing mainly as a novelist, and then the last couple years I've been invited to submit a lot of short stories, so that's been fun. Putting those all across different genres, mainly science fiction, speculative fiction.
Okay. Excellent. Yes. How can they follow you playing at home online? How can they stalk you effectively?
I drive a red truck. and a Toyota truck. I'm MarioAcevedo.com, and I'm also pretty active on Facebook, so okay. They can track me there.
Excellent.
Yeah, that's how I was able to communicate with everybody, was either Facebook or Twitter. Though, surprisingly, certain people, they shall remain nameless, are either not on Facebook or not on Twitter. So there's always, I have to, cross-post all the time to make sure that I catch everybody in my tags.
Yeah.
But, nowadays, authors have to have a social media presence. I mean, you can Google anybody in the book, and you should be able to find them. They all have pretty good websites or Twitter or Facebook accounts when they're active on. They've all been doing a great job promoting this anthology, which I couldn't ask for more. I was very blessed to get these people to write me a story and eternally grateful for it.
So let me ask you this. Do you take submissions? I mean, how do you get are you basically doing your fantasy football league of authors and saying, okay, I need one from him, I need one from him. He's definitely my bookend.
So I'm not a slush pile reading sort of editor. I have done slush in the past, and if I can avoid it, I don't want to do it again. Especially nowadays, because what happened with opening up for digital submissions, the cavalcade, and I've heard this from lots of other, the cavalcade of emails, stories you get that have absolutely nothing to do with your anthology is ridiculous. Nobody reads the guidelines. They're just like, oh, open call, I'm going to send whatever it is that I just wrote, I'm going to send it. They don't read the guidelines. They don't follow the rules. And because of that, you end up spending a lot of time delete, without having read it. It could have been the greatest story in the world, but if it's not right for the anthology and the person can't follow the simplest guidelines, it's got to go in the electronic dump bin.
Right.
And I don't have time for that. I've got other things to do with my life.
Really?
So what I've done, and especially, with Tombstone, I wanted to make sure that, number one, I got to work with my mentors, the people who had influenced me in my writing, and I was fortunate enough to get the majority of them in that one. And then coming into this one, it's like, well, I don't want to go back to the well and just reuse the same people. I have so many friends. I have so many authors who I've read their stories because I've been in anthologies with them. I've had people who have supported me in my career. Travis used to be in my writers group. Mario and I attended a million conventions together at the beginning of our career. He showed me the ropes on so many things. Mario is a fascinating person at a convention because the first time I went to a convention out of town with him, he, sits in a corner of a room, and there's all these wide-eyed, mostly female authors, and others as well, just staring, and he would talk, and they would just stare, because he's got so much wisdom in under that cap. And I always remember that, but he was always making sure I was involved and things like that, and it's like, I need to thank these people, and the only opportunity that I really have to do that is when I do an anthology, and I say, hey, listen,
Travis, I know you write weird westerns. I've read some of them, and I would love to have one from you. And I knew Mario had sent Felix Gomez back to a steampunk west, and I'm like, you got something for me. And it was just, it was easy to find people to give me quality work that made my job editing them so much easier, because I knew they were all solid authors to begin with.
All right.
I just, and yeah.
And the anthology, again, is named Straight Out of Deadwood. I am assuming it is available on Amazon if you are not able to actually make it into a Barnes & Noble these days.
Not Amazon. BarnesandNoble.com.
Barnes & Noble.
Definitely. It's available on the Nook.
Is that still a thing? I thought the Nook died.
Yeah. No, it's still a thing.
Okay. Sure.
No, it's available on all platforms.
Okay.
Including Bain.com, our publisher. Which is really great. Bain does this thing, and highly recommend it. They do e-arcs, where if you want to, you know, get involved and so forth, you can get signed up and read arcs of things as they come out, and actually be able to give feedback back directly to the publisher.
Wow.
And so forth. So
it's a handy tool.
Yeah. So both Tombstone and Deadwood. Were e-arcs, and Dodge City will be too. We're just actually in the proofing the arcs right now, so probably by the end of the year, the first of Dodge City's e-arcs will be out. So,
all right.
Yeah, so definitely check out Bain, and that's BAEN.com.
Excellent. Any words of wisdom for the players at home as we close off and we commence signing books? Travis just kind of gets this pondering look on his face. No.
Wisdom?
Wisdom. No, okay. Fair enough.
Buy lots of books. That's my wisdom.
There we go.
My only thing is, make sure that if you like a story in one of these anthologies, you look up the other people's work, you know, the author's work, their other books, because everybody in here is a hell of a writer. And again, honored to have them as part of it.
Absolutely, because in the end, we're all stories, so make it a good one.